Welcome to SPLIS, a podcast from the Speech, Pronunciation, and Listening intersection of TESOL International. SPLIS provides a space for TESOL professionals to get familiar with the latest trends about all aspects of oral skills and English language teaching.
Welcome to the SPLIS podcast, and today in our very first episode, we have a very special guest, Dr. Tamara Jones. Dr. Tamara Jones is the editor of the best-selling book, Pronunciation in the Classroom, The Overlooked Essential. She has taught in Russia, Korea, England, and Belgium. She's currently the associate director of the English Language Center at Howard Community College in Columbia, Maryland, in the United States. She holds a PhD in education from the University of Sheffield in the United Kingdom. Her most recent book, edited with Marnie Reed, is Listening in the Classroom, Teaching Students How to Listen, published by TESOL Press. Dr. Jones, thank you for joining us today. Welcome to the SPLIS podcast.
Thank you so very much for having me.
And this is what we're going to discuss today, listening comprehension. So, many teachers may take listening comprehension for granted, but it is important to remember that there are reasons why addressing listening comprehension explicitly in the classroom is important. Why do we need to teach listening comprehension?
Well, teaching listening comprehension, I think, first of all, let's talk about the listening comprehension part of that. And listening comprehension is an essential skill for our students. As we mentioned in the introduction of listening in the classroom, Paul Nation tells us that students spend about 50% of their L2 time listening. So our students are doing a lot of listening, and it's really important that when they are listening, they are understanding what they're hearing. And that's not a given. We teach students who may come from cultures where it is awkward or rude to ask the speaker to repeat themselves several times. Even coming from a culture that I do, that I can ask for repetition. I know when I'm listening in my second or my third language, I'm embarrassed to ask for a repetition many, many times. So the listening part of it is just really important for our students' lives, both in maybe in the United States or in North America, or also their lives, any living they do in English elsewhere as well. And so why is it important to teach listening? Well, it's hard for our students. Listening is an incredibly hard skill for them. I mean, you think about all of the things that happen when someone is listening. You have your ears are hit with this stream of spoken sound, and your ears need to, and your brain needs to break up that sound. It needs to break it up into little groups of sounds that are recognizable as words, and then the listener needs to understand how those words work in relationship with other words to form phrases, to form sentences, to form the longer utterance. And this is all happening, and assigning meaning to the words, and assigning a general understanding to the text, the passage, the utterance. And this is all happening at lightning speed. So when students have a problem with listening, if we haven't kind of taught some of the smaller pieces of listening, it's very, very hard for them to understand why they haven't heard something, why they haven't understood what they've heard, why they haven't comprehended it. So if we don't teach these bottom-up listening skills, then our students may misunderstand, and they may not know why they've misunderstood, and they may not know how to fix how to repair that misunderstanding. And then, of course, they're lost when we think of them doing 50% of their L2 work in, you know, in listening. It's essential, and it's really hard.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you talk about the default product-oriented approach that is very common in teaching listening. Could you explain to our listeners what that is and why a different type of approach might be more effective for teaching listening comprehension?
Well, the product-oriented approach is unfortunately how I taught listening, and I'm going to use like air quotes with taught, how I taught listening for years and years and years. And I'm ashamed to admit this now, but you know, I think many of our teachers, our listeners right now and our teachers out there can relate to this. Certainly in the book, many of our authors described a dissatisfaction with how they had been teaching and kind of a longing for a different approach. So this product-oriented approach is where you're really focusing on the answers to a comprehension question. So the way I used to teach listening is I would put the cassette into the cassette player. This was back a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I would press play and I would tell my students to, you know, answer the questions, true, false, multiple choice, you know, whatever was in the textbook. And then I would rewind the cassette. I would play it again for the students. I would tell them to check their answers. And then we would do an answer check as a class. And, you know, for many, many years, that's really how I covered listening. If I was feeling really creative, we might have done a warm-up where the students maybe had generated some vocabulary associated with the topic or whatever. But the focus was really on those comprehension questions. Did they get it right? And if so, hooray. And if not, then, sorry, but that wasn't the right answer. The answer was D or false or whatever, and mm-hmm. move on. So that's the kind of product-oriented approach. And of course, as we know, the problem is that when students get it wrong, they don't know why they've gotten it wrong. They don't know how to fix, how to get it right the next time if we haven't kind of adopted a more process-oriented approach. So it's this idea that we want to focus on some of the places where breakdowns could occur in the listening process and help students navigate through that process to get to the correct answer. And so if we are neglecting all those steps, that the bottom up part, the weaker listeners, as research tells us, the weaker listeners really struggle. And a lot of our textbooks, I mean, you know, teachers aren't to blame for this necessarily. A lot of our textbooks really focus on a little bit of maybe background building or interest generation, a little conversation beforehand. Maybe you look at a picture before you do the listening. And then our textbooks give us a text, listening comprehension questions, and then maybe a discussion afterwards. But what we need to do and what we need to push for is more of that bottom-up skill building so that when students don't understand something, they can go back and kind of figure out how to arrive at a better understanding of the listening text.
More of a bottom-up approach, or more emphasis on that bottom-up approach. And I remember at the end of your chapter, you mentioned something about that no matter how much top-down skills you may get, at some point those are not enough, right?
That's exactly right. So research tells us that strong listeners make good use of the top-down, but they often, when there is a misunderstanding where they're not quite catching everything that's being said, those bottom-up skills will kick into action. And weaker listeners use those bottom-up skills. They rely on them extremely heavily in the listening process. So if students don't have those bottom-up skills, then the weaker listeners will really struggle, and the stronger listeners will also run into problems. So it's certainly, you know, a good use of class time to do some bottom-up skill building. It's incredibly important. And this was something I didn't know until I attended a TESOL conference and happened to have picked one of our authors. She wound up writing a chapter for our book. Beth Shepherd was giving a presentation on bottom-up skill building. And it was like, all of a sudden, my mind was blown by this. I thought, oh my gosh, I've not been doing this for years. And if I can incorporate some bottom-up skill building, what a service I will be doing to my students.
Mm-hmm. And along the lines of bottom-up skills, you make a case in your book about teaching word recognition. So why is word recognition so important for listening comprehension?
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned this. This was my chapter that I wrote in the book. That was my contribution. And I did write about word recognition because it was something that I encountered. I'm Canadian, and so I studied French as a second language for much of my time in public school and university in Canada. And yet, when I lived in Belgium, I often found it really hard to understand what I was hearing. So maybe I wasn't a very good student. That's entirely possible. But also I was having trouble often recognizing words that I knew when I saw them. I begin my chapter with an anecdote about hearing, I was getting to a meeting and a person who was supposed to be in the meeting with me was coming out and she was saying, and I'm not going to try to replicate this with my really bad French accent, but she was basically saying the meeting is canceled. And I couldn't understand. I asked her to repeat it again. She did. I still didn't understand. So she went off. I walked around the corner and I saw a sign that said the meeting is canceled. And I thought, oh, I know the word meeting and I know the word canceled. And yet and the context was all there. I mean, I was going into the meeting. She was coming out of the meeting. All the top-down clues in the world were not helping me understand that the meeting had been canceled. And so that was kind of a real light bulb moment for me. I thought, oh, you know, that's interesting. I know these words. Why can't I understand what she was saying? And so I think understanding words, again, like the students are learners. In fact, we right now are doing so many things when we're listening. There's this stream of speech. It's hitting my ears. And I have to make very quick decisions about where I'm going to divide up that stream to make words. And then I have to attach a meaning to those words. And then I have to kind of understand in a larger context what those words also mean. And the problem is that when our students learn vocabulary, they are very often learning the citation form. So they study from a vocabulary list. They will look at a dictionary. Like this is all in print, right? And they write the word. But we know that English has a very loose sound spelling correspondence. In other words, what a word looks like and what a word sounds like are completely different, two different things entirely. I mean, there's so many the word eight, the number eight, E-I-G-H-T, how in the world does that spell the sounds eight? But, yes. You know, so there's, yeah, it's crazy, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this really loose sound spelling correspondence. So when our students are learning the citation or the written forms of words that don't sound like how they look like they should sound, that's a real challenge for the students. And then you throw in all of the crazy things that happen with reduced sounds in English. So the example I give in my chapter is the word photographer. It's P-H-O, right? But it sounds like F because the vowel sound of unstressed syllables is reduced to that schwa. So the only syllable that's really clear in the word photographer is tog. And to a practiced, strong English listening ear, we can pick out that word just because of that stressed syllable. But if our students are trying to listen for the P-H-O-T-O-G-R-A-P-H-E-R, if they're trying to listen for all of that, they're not going to hear that. And so I think sometimes the meaning of the word gets lost in those reduced syllables, and our students have to become practiced at not only navigating the loose sound spelling correspondence of English, but also understanding what the vowel is in all of those reduced syllables as well. So in English, understanding and recognizing words and streams of speech, that's a really challenging thing for students to do. And they need explicit instruction, and they also need a lot of practice.
Absolutely. Now, many teachers may be familiar with different strategies for word recognition when it comes to teaching reading comprehension, for example, like using morphemes to identify the grammatical category of a word. Now, what are some similar strategies teachers could implement in class to help learners recognize words in listening comprehension?
So in my chapter, I talk a lot about some different activities, and we should say that the book is organized with practicing teachers as the target audience. So if you are in a classroom, this book will be helpful for you. Each chapter starts with a little anecdote from the author about most of them are bottom-up skills, but whatever kind of skill their chapter is targeting, they have a little anecdote about it. And then they have a brief overview of some of the research related to that particular skill. The bulk of each chapter is full of in the classroom, boots on the ground, practice activities that you can do with your students to help raise their awareness and to give them additional practice and additional time with these skills. So that's one of the things I'm very proud of about this book, is there's so much in there for classroom teachers. So to go back to your question about what different strategies teachers can use, first of all, it's important that students can recognize English sounds. And so it's helpful to do activities. For example, if students are having trouble differentiating between a couple of sounds, for example, some of my students from Korea have trouble differentiating between p and th. You'll know which sounds your students have trouble differentiating between, because you'll know a little bit about their language. You'll also maybe notice what sounds they have trouble pronouncing. And so that might be a good indication that these will be sounds that they need some extra work on. But to help students differentiate between these sounds would be to explicitly teach the difference between these sounds, how they're formed in the mouth, how they sound different, how their spelling might be different as well, and then do some practice activities like choose some minimal pair words and say one of the words. For example, you could choose the words pun and fun, and you say one word like fun, and your students have to hold up one finger if they heard the p sound or two fingers if they heard the f sound. So if I said fun, hopefully my students would all hold up two fingers because they've identified instead of. So those kinds of practice activities can be really useful. Also, a little tip with that, if you're doing any kind of differentiation with minimal pairs with your students, especially when they look really different to pronounce, for example, the difference between how your lips are pressed together for p and how your top teeth rest on your bottom lip for f, then you can hold up a piece of paper in front of your mouth so your students don't see what you're doing with your mouth, and instead they have to really rely on what they're hearing, or maybe turn around, or if you're on Zoom, you can turn your camera off while you're doing this kind of activity so students can't rely on the visual clues. They really have to listen. So kind of, and there's lots of games, any kind of game that you would play where students were choosing one thing over the other, like the fly swatter game where you have the two sounds up on the board and you break your students into two groups and give each group a fly swatter, and they have to race to touch the correct sound. Those kinds of like races, anything like that can be really fun for students. So first of all, teaching sound recognition, and then we want to teach sound spelling correspondences, so that students become really aware of what the words look like and what they sound like, and making that connection between the two of them. So things, I know dictations are really old fashioned and probably a little bit out of fashion, but doing dictations with students. So you say the word and they write the word, or they fill in the vowel sounds of the word or something like that, can be absolutely eye-opening for them when they realize that what they are hearing and writing is not what the teacher is saying. Things like also then moving on to teach things like syllables and word stress, so students become aware of those reduced syllables and what they sound like. And I'm a really big advocate for choral repetition. I've done probably hundreds of observations of teachers in my lifetime. And I have never left a classroom and thought, wow, that was too much choral repetition. We tend to repeat a couple of times. If we're really big advocates of choral repetition, we might make our students repeat it a couple of times. I've very often seen teachers say the word more times than their students do. And I think, well, that's great, but my pronunciation of the word is pretty good. I don't need the practice, my students do. So any kind of choral repetition where the teacher provides the model, or the recording provides the model, and the students have to repeat and kind of get the syllables down with clapping, and then also stress and body movements, like an open hand for the stressed syllable and a closed hand for the unstressed syllable, those kinds of things can be really helpful for students to start to get a sense of how syllables and stress impact how the vocabulary words they are learning sound.
Great. And finally, what's your general advice for teachers who want to implement more listening comprehension instruction in their classes?
Well, of course, my first piece of advice is go out and buy the book, buy the Listening in the Classroom book, because as I said, it's organized to be hopefully very user-friendly and full of really great teaching ideas. Our goal was to have the TESOL equivalent of a beach read for a book, something that was just easy to read and useful at the same time. But also to start to think about having students do a little bit of diagnosing of their own listening challenges. There's a couple of chapters in the book on metacognitive awareness and how students thinking about the mistakes they're making when they do these listening comprehension questions that are in all of our textbooks, and having them identify where things are going wrong. Is it because they didn't understand some of the words? Did they understand all of the words, but they couldn't separate the stream of speech into the words? If they read the text, can they understand the words, what the text is about, but they couldn't when it was being played without looking at the text? Having students diagnose their own listening challenges can be a great springboard for teachers to create some bottom-up listening activities on their own too. So find out where your students are struggling, listen to them, and then figure out from there how to help them with those bottom-up skills.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Tamara Jones, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you so much, and good listening, everyone.
And remember, the book is called Listening in the Classroom, Teaching Students How to Listen, edited by Marnie Reed and Tamara Jones, and published by TESOL Press. This concludes our podcast episode. Thank you for joining us today.
This has been a presentation of SPLIFS, a podcast from the Speech, Pronunciation, and Listening Interest section of TESOL International. Please remember to subscribe to SPLIFS through your favorite podcast listening platform. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.